It's a scam, it's a scandal, it's certainly rather immoral, and it's been covered up by multiple governments because they feel that it's much more important to have jobs in factories making biscuits, for example, in their constituency, than to actually create a better, healthier food environment.
Tim, what do you mean by why almost everything we've been told about food is wrong?
I mean that most of the stuff in textbooks you read on government websites that you hear in the media are giving us completely the wrong idea about food and are based on out-of-date concepts about nutrition and food that came from the war years and starvation and really have no place in our modern world. There are some facts that are correct, there are many that are not, and I think it's really a total misunderstanding now that we've got to deal with.
So give us the facts you think are correct, the main ones, and then let's go into all the things you think are wrong.
Eating more fruits and vegetables, eating more fibre, they're all good. Eating less fat is not correct. Eating regularly throughout the day, never skipping meals, is incorrect. Exercising to reduce weight is incorrect. Reducing, having low calorie foods is incorrect. Having low fat substitutes for whole fat is incorrect. So depending on which the guidelines you're looking at, they're probably the main ones, the main myths. And the particular one that overrides all of these is that calorie counting is a successful way to lose weight.
Okay, so would love to explore all of those, but on a higher level, why is the information out of date? Why are these new facts not being shared with the world?
Nutrition works very slowly, and in the UK, for example, to get nutritional guidelines out, it takes various committees that have to be formed. And currently those committees are formed of nutrition academics working in universities, but they have representatives of the food industry on those committees, deciding what guidelines we should have for our diet. And they often meet only once every year or every 2 years, and it takes so many approvals to get these guidelines through. It can take several years to move these guidelines through the dozen or so government departments that it can literally take a decade to get any change through. And so as well as the bureaucracy, there's also the fact that the food industry doesn't want guidelines to change because they're very happy with the ones they've got, allows them to sell lots of rubbish food to us under a healthy label. And the more we fiddle with those rules, regulations, guidelines, the more they have to work to change their products and cause problems. So given the enormous lobbying of the food industry on government ministries, or the fact they're embedded in the decision-making process, it's not surprising that everything is at least 10 years out of date and not up to speed with asking, say, a survey of nutrition professors in this country.
Does that feel like a scam to you, that the food industry is controlled maybe to a larger degree by the people who have ulterior motives to sell us easy, cheap, fast, high profit margin food?
It's a scam, it's a scandal, it's certainly rather immoral, and it's been covered up by multiple governments because they feel that it's much more important to have jobs in factories making biscuits, for example, in their constituency, than to actually create a better, healthier food environment for individuals. So they've favoured the politics of cheap food, of having a cheap food industry in this country, above the health impact that has on the population and the sort of fat tax that we're all paying for the obesity crisis, the diabetes, which has worked out at about £600 a year tax, essentially, we're paying for the extra obesity due to poor foods.
Wow. And how are we paying that tax?
We pay it through the healthcare, extra healthcare costs we have to pay, through the unemployment disability healthcare costs that we all pay, time off work, all these other indirect ways, which we don't see, but are there. And that's why the UK is probably the most unhealthy nation in Europe and the one that eats the most ultra-processed food.
How do we change this?
Podcasts like this, people understanding the problem, people talking to their MPs. But, you know, the plans have been sent to the government, and the National Food Strategy that I helped advise on by Henry Dimbleby did give this large document to the government, which they request, they asked for that, they asked for a report, it was delivered. They have ignored so far vast majority of the recommendations on nutrition. They've accepted some of the agricultural ones on the environment. Virtually all the nutrition ones have said no. And the reaction of the present government, whether it was Boris or any of the other short-term prime ministers, has been, we're not going to tax food. That's not going to be popular. And we have to suddenly, we have to change things. And what that report did show, however, that if you did have a strong government that created a playing field that was even for all these food companies, they're not evil, they just want to do better than their competitors, otherwise they'd get the sack. If you created a playing field that was absolutely fair, they would reduce the harmful effects of that food very, very rapidly, and they would reformulate, or they would accept higher charges on that food in order to subsidize real foods, real fruits and vegetables, and stop this increasing gap between the two that seems to be inevitable unless we do something, as ultra-processed food is done, made by robots in factories. Real food is picked by people by hand, and those two are getting further and further apart. So governmental action is one thing. The other is people voting themselves with their food choices. And I think the most important thing people can do for their health is their own individual food choice. It beats anything else. It beats, you know, going to the gym or deciding to live in the country or do anything else. Every single day, the choices we make about our food are the most important ones we can make for our health and our families, and also, interestingly, the environment. So the most important impact we as individuals in the UK can have on climate change is to alter what we eat. So I think there is an optimism that if we accept that governments aren't going to change, they're going to continue to be lobbied by the food industry, and the consumer does have this power. And I think what I've been writing my books, particularly the last one, Food for Life, is a sort of practical guide about what to do, what to choose when you go to a supermarket, which can be otherwise baffling. And if people do make those choices, the supermarkets will start stocking them and they will change their buying practices. And the one good thing we have in this country is we are able to make rapid cultural changes in our food. When I first started writing my books on the microbiome, no one had heard of kefir kombucha. Now, in every supermarket you go to, and most pubs, you can buy a kombucha. It was amazing. You know, 5 years ago, it didn't exist. So people demand it, it can be there. And the same can be true for our supermarkets. We could get rid of some of the products like, you know, children's yogurt, which should come with a health warning, and get rid of all those low-fat yogurts if people stopped buying them and told their friends, don't buy this stuff, it's bad for you. Mm. So I think, you know, you know, it's always possible the next government that comes in might actually have this on their agenda. But given most governments are short term, they can only think of the next sort of 4 years. Mm. The idea of saving money over a 10-year period isn't appealing in our current system. So I think we have to rely on individual consumers and individual champions going out there and saying, let's champion real food quality, let's get the health of our nation better. Mm.
So let's dig into, I think you said, four or five main areas where the information is out of date and wrong. And the one that raised my eyebrows from personal experience was the calorie counting one. So can you just say again what you said? Was it something along the lines of calorie counting doesn't lose weight? Was that what you said? Or can you put it in your own words? The myth.
Right, well, there's sort of two aspects to this. One is that one myth is that calorie counting is fairly easy to do and everyone, the public, should do it. That's why the government provides these calorie counts on foods, etc. So the first thing is they're not accurate. They plus or minus 20%, and they don't take anything to do with the structure of food. So cheap processed food will have the same calorie score as a really high quality food, yet a completely different effect on your body and your appetite. Even professionals cannot accurately calorie count. Most of the stuff in restaurants, plus or minus 50%, because the portion sizes vary. So you've got no real idea what you're actually consuming. You're just sort of pretending you do. So it's really difficult to do that. And then the other point is, if you try and restrict calories as your main way of losing weight, and say you do it quite dramatically, so you adjust, you know, you're not worried about these small margins. You say reduce 600 calories a day, and you're having less than 1,500 calories a day. So you will lose weight for a few weeks. Nearly everyone does, but progressively as you lose weight, your body responds by shutting down its metabolism, reducing the amount of energy you're burning in everyday life, even when you're asleep or when you're watching telly or anything else. And it also ramps up your hunger levels in your brain, so that it's like a thermostat's being notched up. And it starts to really kick in after about a month. You start saying, you know, my body thinks I'm starving here. If I don't do something, I'm going to die. Let's just ramp up that appetite level that, you know, when Tim sees a donut in a shop, you know, he's just going to get that extra pleasure buzz saying, buy me, buy me. And that just keeps ramping up, so 10% every month, until most people crack and start feeling incredible hunger pangs, start dreaming of food, and they break this cycle. And that's why in all the trials, you know, vast majority of people revert back to their baseline after a couple of years, and very few people are able to sustain it for longer. You know, and those people might be special, have some special willpower, or less susceptible to these hunger signals in the brain. But virtually all the studies done have shown that vast majority of people fail if they use long-term calorie restriction as their method of controlling their weight. And the other big thing that's wrong about it is if you're obsessed with calories, and this is what, you know, we're being told, bombarded with adverts, and you go to the supermarket, I was every low calorie this, low fat, reduced sugar. Oh, that's great. You have this stuff instead of making your own, because you're not quite sure what's in your own stuff. It's quite hard to measure the calories. So you buy the stuff from ready-made foods, etc. Studies have now shown that if you have identical calorie meals, one homemade, one ready-made, you will be eating at least 300 extra calories a day on the ready-made one. So they make you hungrier.
Right.
They're so brilliantly created by these food scientists who work for these companies. They've got that exact mix of sugar, fats, and salt that just make it irresistible. So it doesn't fill you up. And it's also, because it's ultra-processed, it means that it doesn't have any whole ingredients in it. It's all the extracts of real food that have gone into it. So you've got two equivalent sort of burgers, if you like, or whatever it is you're talking about. one, or ready meal of lasagna or whatever it is, one will just be ground up so finely that everything is absorbed super rapidly into your body, doesn't get to your gut, there's hardly any fiber in there, and triggers these, doesn't trigger the fullness signals that real food does. So that's why I think this country's so obese is not because we're eating so many extra calories, but 57% of the calories adults eat is ultra-processed food, which makes them overeat. And even if they think it's health food, it's actually this cycle that we're perpetuating. And no one is standing up and saying, hey guys, this is wrong. We shouldn't be selling this stuff in the health food section. We shouldn't be selling this stuff to kids. And kids are eating over 70-75% of their calories in this fashion. And that's why we've got so many obese children. And it's worse in the more deprived areas of the country that have difficult access to these. It's worse in poorly educated. And so we're just increasing this massive health burden and sleepwalking into it.
Is obesity a disease?
It depends who you ask and what the purpose of it is. I think if it isn't a disease, some people call it a lifestyle. it's something that is a major risk factor for many diseases. And I think it is best thought of as a disease. And because otherwise it's saying it's voluntary. And I think most of the people in this country haven't suddenly lost their willpower in the last 40 years. Their genes haven't changed. Their food environment has changed, and the food they are told is healthy has changed. And so I think it's more helpful to call it a disease than it is a lifestyle. And you're not stigmatizing people. You're saying, well, you've got this combination of factors that makes you more susceptible to it. We do know there is some genetic basis to obesity. Some people get these huge appetite signals more than others. So if you give everyone the same food, they do react differently. And so if something has a genetic basis, you know you can induce it. It changes over time. And that it's not purely down to willpower. I think you call it a disorder or a disease. It doesn't worry me to call it that. And I think, you know, obesity has about the same risk of dying as an average diagnosis of cancer. So you wouldn't say, well, cancer's a lifestyle choice. You know, a lot of people get it. It's gone up a bit over time. You know, it's a lifestyle choice if you smoke cigarettes or you eat lots of bad food. So, yeah, I think I'm happy for the purposes, particularly of informing the public, to talk about it as a disease.
If we talk about it as a disease, does it not maybe take away the proactive lifestyle changes to lose the weight? And whereas people might thought about that's discipline in what you eat or calorie counting, maybe you would say it's home cooking, eating whole foods, etc. So does the disease label not make someone, because if you have a disease, you go to the doctor to get a cure.
In the old model, yes. You're not going to get much of a cure if you go at the moment to see your doctor.
If you can get in.
Exactly. so most people wouldn't bother. Mm. As I said, these labels are depending on what you're using it for. But if I think calling it a disease means you take it seriously. Mm. And if people took obesity more seriously, particularly in kids, and they saw how their lifespan is going to be diminished, and if adults saw that once they're obese, you know, the chances of having all their joints replaced and not being able to walk and getting diabetes and obesity and cancers were increased so much, I think people would take it more seriously. And I think, you know, I think obesity is a great example of how we need to talk about prevention more than just treating the disease. And that's why we need a, you know, it's a misnomer to call us a National Health Service. It's the National Disease Service, right? So why don't we call it, you know, change the name, you know, National Prevention Service. You know, it'd be so much better if we actually were able to do that rather than only dealing with the all the side effects of these problems. So, but it's so widespread, you know, affecting a third of people that clearly the medical profession itself couldn't cope with it. But I think to be taken seriously, that's what is needed. I mean, there are these, you know, there are a couple of cures. Let's not forget, there's a drug you can take now for diabetes and for some situations of extreme obesity, a weekly injection.
And what does that do?
That switches your appetite signals off.
Right.
And so essentially, with this regular injection, you don't feel those same hunger pangs. And so nearly everyone loses weight on that. But you have to be on it for life. And it's several hundred pounds a month. And as soon as you stop it, your appetite goes through the roof. So, you know, do you really want 10-year-old kids you know, on this, which we don't know the very long-term effects of, and whether it has other effects on the brain or not. And the other treatment is bariatric surgery, where you move a bit of the stomach, you cut out a bit of the stomach and you join it up, so you've got less intestine, and essentially that moves, changes your anatomy of your gut, changes the gut microbes in there as well, and that has a 75% sort of permanent success rate as well. That's an operation that we're not doing nearly enough of in this country. Has dramatic results, and with 24 hours you can cure diabetes. So there are, if we took it seriously, more people would be probably getting these treatments, which would eventually save the taxpayer a lot of money, because these very obese people do use huge resources, you know, not only the personal cost to them, but also to society.
So I want to come back to the NHS in a moment. I have a car in this race, in that I used to be fat. And when I was 11 to 13, I was pretty much the fattest kid in my year. Well, I was the fattest kid in my year. And I don't know if I was obese, but if I was carrying on down that road, I would have been. And I hated myself. And I remember at the time, Diet Coke had just come out. So we're talking like 30 years probably here, Tim. And I just got sold. Oh, okay. I didn't just think that there was no calories in Diet Coke, therefore you're not having calories. I actually thought, if you drink Diet Coke, you will lose weight.
It's on the label, isn't
it? Yeah. So
it's like a diet.
Yeah. And so I lost 3 stone in 8 weeks. So when I went to a private school and we had a longer holiday, so we had 8 instead of 6. And I begged my mum and dad to get me to leave the school. We were just going into the senior school. The bullying I was getting was getting up and up. The senior school kids were going to kill me. And I begged them to let me leave, and they did. And I'd been working up in my mind that I wanted to lose weight. But my mum and dad didn't know anything about food. We were raised in pubs. They would always just buy Jaffa cakes and donuts and things like that. And I definitely, I look back, what was it that made me overweight? It was probably a sugar addiction, if I could put it down to one thing, a sugar addiction and craving all the time. And every day I'd drink about 8 cans of Diet Coke, did that every day for 8 weeks. And I'd eat nothing for about two and a half days. And then I'd either have a feast lolly, which I think were 300 calories, or a packet of fruit pastels. And and then the occasional emergency food.
A great diet.
Yeah, exactly. But
don't try this at home,
no,
kids.
No. But I lost 3 stone in 8 weeks, and that was a great thing for me. And so calorie counting and reducing calories obviously worked for me to lose weight.
Well, not eating, it sounds like.
Not counting anything. There's a few questions that come up. One, I wanted just to give context that I'm not just here talking about stuff, I've lived it myself. Mm. So there's a couple of things, something I want to talk about towards the end is the emotional baggage I still carry around food every day, because I do, because that's not gone. But being in a calorie deficit worked for me and probably saved my life in many ways. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I definitely wanted to ask you is, calorie counting doesn't work for weight loss, but it did for me.
Yeah, well, I always say it didn't work for most people.
Yeah.
And clearly it does work for some people. You are clearly highly motivated. You didn't want to go back to school and be bullied.
Mm.
And bullying is a strong factor. One reason they think there's less obesity in France is there's lots of bullying, particularly of women.
So it's a strong motivator to lose weight.
Yes, to conform and lose weight, which there isn't. Not saying I'm. That's something we should.
My wife's reacting there. Go on, say something. Oh, okay, you're just watching. I thought I saw her eyebrows go. But carry on.
So you were highly motivated.
Yeah.
You had a terrible diet, presumably, before that.
Yes. Yeah.
And it worked for you. And I mean, I wasn't surprised you lost the weight. I guess the key, because nearly everyone will lose weight if they go, they really eat nothing and just drink Diet Coke. Okay. But the question is, it didn't come back, and at 4 years you weren't back to where you were, which is what happens to 80% of people in all the trials. Okay.
80% of people go back to their original weight.
Yes.
So.
Trials, and it's probably more than that in real life,
because
they're really supervised and sort of looked after, not left to your own devices like you were.
So no, I didn't, but I fight it off every day, and I have done for 30 years. So this is the sort of second part to the question. If I was left to my own devices, I would just gorge everything. I love eating, love it.
And you have a big appetite signal that just sort of says, lights up in your brain and says, eat me.
Yeah, like those cookies that are sat there that we're all pretending aren't there, Tim. They are what?
I hadn't noticed them.
We're like, stick her in the corner, Tim's coming. Something you said, which I agree with, is I've got no subjectivity on my hunger desires, because not in your brain, and I don't know what yours is like. But if you ask my wife, I think about food all the time. I love food. I get a lot of pleasure out of food. We went to the Ivy. It was delicious. I loved it. I want to eat and eat and eat. I want to eat everyone else's food as well. I don't want to stop. So therefore, I assume I have got a strong hunger. So I fight it all the time. It's so exhausting, actually. Mm. And it brings up sort of emotional self-worth issues. Yeah, so.
And how did you get over that original period? So your 8 cans of Diet Coke, just to sort of keep your brain busy thinking it's having something sweet and fooling it.
Yeah.
The odd periods of nothing, and then a Jaffa cake occasionally and a fruit pastille. But
We won't read that in your books, will we? No.
Well, my diet as a kid wasn't much better, but I say like Jaffa cakes, if we have that in common.
Yeah, yes.
we all got our... But yeah, I'm not driven by food, and I can easily distract myself. So I find time-restricted eating relatively easy, but I know many of my colleagues find it really hard.
Can you explain what that is, time-restricted
eating? Yeah, it's a form of intermittent fasting, is this umbrella term for what, in a way, you were doing as a kid. Just say, I'm not going to eat for 2 days, and just have my Diet Coke. And it used to be called, there was a form of it called the 5-2 diet about 10 years ago, people might remember, which was you ate 500 calories for 1 day and then sort of slightly over it the next day and then 500 the next day. But this is the new form that is much more popular, much more sustainable, where you don't change what you eat, you just change the time in which you eat it. So you have to eat generally within a 10-hour time window. And this means that you have 14 hours overnight when your body's resting, your cells repair, your gut microbes are healing your gut, and your metabolism is much more efficient. So most people get on with this pretty well and can sustain it for years, even if they don't do it every day. And naturally, they just tend to eat less calories because they know they're not allowed to grab a big, you know, digestive biscuit before they're going to bed, or cake, or, you know, these sort of late night snacks in front of the telly.
Yeah.
To say no, nothing after 9 and nothing before 11 in the morning, or whatever suits them. But some people, like a couple of my colleagues, Sarah and Jonathan at work, have been trying this and can't do it. They're really suffering. They're just thinking about food all the time. I find it relatively easy, as long as I get enough inside me in that time, and I know that I can eat it, you know, after 11 or 12.
Mm.
I can skip breakfast, for example. I don't feel hungry as soon as I wake up. I know some people that's not the case. So there's this big variability between people and how they do it. And I think what your story is, and I think a lot of kids with obesity are driven, different drivers of that, you know, that search for food that needs to be tackled. But, and as I said, there is this new drug that actually can just, in a way, switch it off, that signal, which people find amazing. And they feel it's like a release, you know, it's suddenly...
Because it can be it is torture and torment at times.
Yeah, people describe it like an opiate, you know, craving.
Yeah.
That, you know, oh my, I'm being driven, you know, I'm really hungry. And yet, you know, you've gone through this fasting period, so you know you survive.
Yeah.
You know you're...
For years, people have been asking me where I buy my watches. Many of you may know I'm a watch collector, I'm a watch investor, and those as an asset class have done me very well in the last 15 years. I have never shared where I source my watches from or my watch dealer until now. My watch dealer used to be a professional footballer for Manchester United, and he formed a watch brand called Broadwalk. And he sources the higher-end brands like Rolex, Audemars Piguet, Patek Philippe and Richard Mille. I trust him, I've used him for many years, and recently we've done a partnership. Hence, I'm inviting you, if you want to start investing in watches and protect your money from the banks and inflation, to check out Broadwalk. That's Broadwalk. And the website is broadwalkgroup.com. The email is sales@broadwalkgroup.com. And please don't share this, but his number is 07496 878153. Obviously, only message him if you're serious about buying and investing in the higher-end watches. People have been asking me for years, and for the first time ever, you can get access to my watch team.
It's not, you can go several days without eating. As long as you're drinking, it's fine. And I think, you know, a lot of people don't go through that. And I think that one reason that these intermittent fasting things are a good thing for everyone to try is because it's pretty natural in us as humans that we've all gone through evolution with periods of famine, fasting and famine, and feasting.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that was more of our... And we're designed to do exactly that, and our body will just shift its metabolism to cope. And but it's natural that, you know, we seek food, otherwise we'd die.
Mm.
But I think it's we're learning more and more about appetite and how it changes with these hormones and the effects of our gut health on that. But I'm interested how you managed to do this if you're still on a very high sugar diet, you know. So we do know that lots of foods have different effects on appetite, and this hasn't been really studied much, and it's something we're doing with a company I co-founded, Zoe, Precision Nutrition, trying to see which foods would give you the suppress your appetite the most. And so hopefully, you know, in the next year, we've already, you know, done most of the carbohydrates in terms of sugar peaks and fat peaks and gut health, but it'd be lovely to have a list of foods personalized to you that say, well, how many of these do I need to eat to fill me up, to suppress that appetite signal, which could be quite different for different people. But we do know that in general, ultra-processed foods, high sugar foods, don't sort out that craving. They can actually make it worse. Mm. Whereas generally, proteins and fats and high fiber tend to do that. But I think we haven't really scratched the surface of that yet, and whether some people that's not the case. You know, there are some people that fats might make them hungrier, or carbs might ease that craving, and proteins might have different effects. So I think it is fascinating that as we change our ideas about obesity, we sort of, the science has to catch up. Mm. We were hoping there'd be some magic gene that we could just switch off.
Right.
And that was one of the things I've been studying for 25 years. It turns out there's over 1,000 genes for obesity.
Wow.
And the biggest one only has a 1% effect.
Right.
So it's not going to be much use if you switch that off.
No.
So we've got to look for other mechanisms. That's why I, you know, focusing on food quality and how that affects the gut microbes, and how those gut microbes can send signals to your brain to say, I'm full.
Yeah.
And I think if we understand that more, we will start to help, you know, kids like you get through this without starvation and perhaps ruining your health with all these synthetic foods just to get you, you know, from being bullied.
Mm. So I've got a few questions that come out of that, but my wife has to go soon. And we've got Rob's wife round.
I have one.
We've never. She's bless you, honey. Yeah, sure. We've never done a Rob's wife round. You did say you wanted me to ask these. Yeah, of course. So, Tim, this is a Disruptors podcast first in nearly 1,000 episodes. We've got a Rob Moore's wife round.
How exciting!
So, is organic food worth the money?
It depends. Depends how much money you've got. If you're rich, it absolutely is. If you're on the other end of the scale, I think you've got to weigh up the pros and cons. And it might be particularly worthwhile if you're feeding a young child or you're pregnant. They're the times you're most vulnerable. And interestingly, if you are predominantly a vegetarian, it's even more valuable in order to reduce the amount of herbicides and pesticides you're ingesting. So I think the jury's out, and I sort of go into this in my book, Spoonfed and Food for Life, in quite a bit of detail, and it's hard to get definitive data. The observational epidemiology data, when you follow people like a large group of 80,000 people in France who ate organic food against those who didn't, they ended up having less cancers and less heart disease, living longer. Some of that might be the bias of people who want to buy healthy food, have other health lifestyle benefits. And if you look at the detailed studies, there's no doubt organic food has a fifth of the amount of herbicides and pesticides. And some of these have been associated, things like glyphosate, Roundup, which is everywhere, which all of us ingest. Even organic vegetarians are having lots of it all our lives. Increased rates of some cancers and some immune problems. And some Californian courts have awarded damages of several billions for some rather rare cases of cancer. But there's no clear evidence, really, that the nutrient benefits are much greater. They're slightly greater, but not much greater. So I think, for me, the main reason is to buy organic is to know that you're getting less pesticides, less herbicides, which are affecting your gut microbes. because we know that they've been shown to be fairly safe against human genes, and they just knock out plant and weed genes, but they do affect our gut microbes. So in an ideal world, we'd all be eating organic foods. So if you've got the money, I think it is worthwhile. If you're sort of on the breadline, I think you're better off just choosing as many good fruits and vegetables as you can, and take your chances.
What coffee do you drink?
I drink a mixture of Nespresso capsules and generally espresso filter coffee. And I change my blends all the time. In the evening, I'll have decaf coffee. And I try and get 3 cups of coffee a day for its health benefits.
Is there a particular coffee that's more healthy for your microbiome?
According to the epidemiology, there's not much difference between them. Even instant coffee has some benefits for your general health. They haven't studied them all in terms of the microbiome, so we don't know that much. And even decaf coffee has health benefits. We think most of the benefits come from, firstly, the fiber, and also defense chemicals in the coffee called polyphenols. And all types of coffee have these polyphenols, but I am getting sent samples of coffee now from people wanting to plug it that have high levels of polyphenols in them. They tend to be more expensive, but I think the market is going towards realizing that coffee isn't a sort of dangerous drink, it's now a health drink, and they're trying to increase the amount of fiber in it, increase these healthy chemicals. So, you know, I'm actively doing testing every week on new coffees and seeing which ones are good for me. And we're doing some studies on this as well to see which coffee best grows particular microbes in our gut. So at Zoe, with my colleagues in the microbiome group, we've identified one microbe that only lives off coffee. So we can tell by studying anyone's poo whether they're a regular coffee drinker or not, just by this one microbe called Lawsonobacter. And so we can study how that grows and, you know, hopefully start to do some real research to fine tune it.
All right. What red wine do you drink? These sound like questions on a date night, honey. We were doing these at 7 in the morning. Yeah, what red wine do you drink?
For me, for my shopping list.
Yeah.
Tick. Yeah. Coffee.
Yeah, was this again for if a red wine is more healthy?
Well, the polyphenols again.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know whether there was one that was better than
another. I drink red wine that I enjoy is my primary reason to drink it. I would never drink a red wine I didn't like, just for its health properties. And epidemiology does show that red wine, 1 to 2 glasses a day, increases your gut microbiome health, your gut health. So, again, there are some producers that claim to have very high levels of polyphenols in them. I think these are mainly expensive wines from Tuscany. But I believe that most red wines from Italy, from Spain, France have high levels of polyphenols in them. And I think, again, in the future, like the coffee, we're going to see some producers starting to measure them accurately and give us good feedback on this.
Mm. How much meat do you eat?
I eat meat once or twice a month. And
Harry and usually, I eat more than that in a day.
Usually when my wife, who's a Belgian carnivore, says, you have to try this. This is amazing. And I did give up meat completely for several years, but I started to develop a vitamin B12 deficiency. And so rather than popping pills, I eat meat once or twice, usually in a really nice restaurant where it's really good quality meat. I will never eat poor quality, never eat processed meats. And I think it's important, if I'm writing about food as well, to be able to taste foods that everyone can enjoy.
Mm.
But I do think it's important for everyone to realise that the most important thing we can do for the planet is to eat less meat.
So you're doing it for the planet, not for your own health?
I'm doing it for both.
Okay.
And as I explain the book, I think eating
which
a small
book?
Amount of
tell
meat...
Tell us which book.
Food for Life.
Yeah.
In the book Food for Life, I explain that eating... The meat itself is not necessarily dangerous for people if it's of high quality. Processed meats, cheap ones, cheap cuts, made in factories of bits stuck together, chicken nuggets, poor quality ham, etc., poor quality sausages, have been shown definitely to be bad for your health, for cancers, heart disease. Good quality meat is not really been shown conclusively to be very bad for you in modest amounts. If you eat a lot of it, it is. And I think there's nothing wrong with having meat, say, once or twice a week, without to have optimal health. The main point of me reducing meat is to have more plants on my plate.
Right.
If you've got a big steak on your plate, you put your potatoes there, you've got your peas, there's no room for anything else. There's no imagination of anything else. You're going to be depriving your gut of something useful. Your gut doesn't really do much with a bit of meat. There are a few microbes that eat that protein and the fat, but mostly, you know, it's the plants you want for gut health. So I always think you've got to think, I think, in nutrition rather than this is good, this is bad. It's you've got to try and think of a holistic approach to what are you eating on that plate that day. What are you eating, you know, overall, all those three meals that day, and how are you eating that week? And I think we need to move away from this idea of this is good, this is bad, you know, and because people get put off if they said, well, I can't eat meat, I'm not going to, you know, follow that diet. Whereas if you just said, well, actually, just have a few vegetarian meals. If people just ate half the meat they normally do, we'd have a massive effect on climate change. You don't have to do like me. You don't have to be a vegan or vegetarian. I think just this gradual, what we call flexitarian move towards appreciating plants and realising that's actually healthy for you and saving the planet.
Harry, I was planning for us, have you seen there's a burger and lobster just round the corner? That's what I thought we were going tonight. lettuce and tomato, yeah, that's where we're going. Right, this isn't my wife's question. I'm going to sneak a couple in here because there's a couple of fascinating high-profile cases I'd like to ask you about. So first off, Jordan Peterson was very public about his all-beef diet and he kept banging on about how that was really good for him. What do you think about an all-beef diet?
I think for most people it's going to be very bad news. I think there are a few people who can tolerate it. Maybe Jordan is one of them. But I'm against diets that are a bit like fundamental religions. And Jordan is someone who was a bit of a religious fanatic on the low-fat diet, who then switched to the other extreme and became a sort of carnivore fundamentalist. And I think anyone who has these rules like super keto or anything else is missing the point. You know, we're omnivores. We're designed to eat all kinds of foods, but mainly plants. And all the evidence suggests is the bigger the diversity of plants we can get into our guts, the healthier we're going to be, the better our immune system. Now, some people find keto diets, carnivore diets, good for losing weight, but everything's good for losing weight short term. And yes, lots of meat does suppresses your hunger for perhaps a bit longer than it just eating carbs. But it's super bad, it's terrible for the planet. It's about the worst thing you could do if you have any sort of conscience about climate change. And it's long-term really bad for your gut health, for most people.
Mm.
You know, you can say, well, Eskimos and various other people have adapted to have those diets. And there will be a small percentage of the population that do tell me, come up to my meetings, I've been eating, you know, three steaks a day for the last 20 years and look at me, I'm marvellous. I say, well, there's plenty of, you know, opposites that aren't. And so generally, yeah, fine exceptions, but don't try and copy them.
Mm. And then I found this, I shouldn't really say amusing, but I did find it amusing. But Virtually every entrepreneur or personal development person I know has been to a Tony Robbins seminar. And I think he's done a lot of great things in that space. And he would really push the no meat, just fish. I've simplified it because he wouldn't have said no meat, just fish. But, you know, he ate a lot of fish for decades. And then a revelation on a podcast, he said he nearly died of mercury poisoning. So I guess a lot of people who are getting rid of meat are eating a lot of fish. What do you think about that?
If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I'd said that was a great idea.
Ah.
But since researching Food for Life and writing the fish chapter, I completely changed my mind. And there's no doubt that on two fronts. One, an environmental front, most of the fish we eat is farmed fish. And to feed a farmed fish, you've got to basically give it 1.5 little fish from the sea to keep it alive. So we are dramatically denuding our oceans and destroying huge bits of fantastic oceanside areas in the Far East, etc. And as you said, you can overdose on mercury in large, if you eat large fish. Generally, small fish, that's not the case. But the other reason I've changed my mind is that I don't think the evidence that fish is that good for you is that strong. I don't think it's harmful for you if you don't have too much mercury in it. But, you know, it seems to be around a 10% advantage for health, which, given the cost of fish and the cost to our environment, means it's vastly overrated as a health food. There are some exceptions to that, and I'm really big on shellfish, and I think the British don't eat enough mussels and clams and oysters, which are...
Does lobster go in that?
lobster is more of a sort of sea insect, isn't okay. it, really? So I think it's halfway there. But, you know, again, if you can find a sustainable lobster farm that doesn't sort of take more to feed it than they actually get out of it, it's possible. But we have, a, you know, but we might be eating land insects more than we are water insects in the future.
Mm.
But I think shellfish are fantastic. They're, you know, they're non-sentient, so they don't feel pain. They are filterers of all the pollution in the water. And, you know, God knows we need that in this country with our, you know, if you ever go surfing and we have terrible water, so they're filtering and they are totally sustainable. And they may have some modest health benefits. They've got protein and other minerals in them as well. And they taste great. So, but I think just buying lots of prawns from Vietnam or Thailand that are, you know, made in atrocious conditions that are destroying the environment there, thinking it's healthy for you, that's something you need to change. So, yeah, fish as a treat, but not as a regular thing that the government tells us we have to eat at least two portions a week to be healthy. Because it all goes along with these studies of omega-3. You've heard of omega. Do you take any omega-3 supplements?
I think, do I, honey? You make up all my supplements, don't you? Oh, okay, yeah. I got like a big box of pills every morning.
Yeah, well, yeah. They're all a waste of time.
Testosterone. They're all a waste of time.
Well, I don't know about the testosterone.
No, that was a joke. That was a joke.
You might need that. I don't know.
She just slips that in.
Slips it in for you.
they're all a waste of... Okay, so what do we put in there? You put NMN and NAD in there, don't you? NAD plus.
Ones that your friend told you to take, so I'm not too sure. But we both do take NMN and
Resveratrol,
is it?
Yeah.
Resveratrol?
That'll be it.
Yeah.
That's in red wine. So most of these are rubbish. Some of them haven't been some of them haven't been tested, right? So some of them are rather experimental, like these NAD ones, these sort of anti-aging products that have only been tested in mice. Haven't had big human trials yet, but the but the common ones, things like omega-3, vitamin C, vitamin D.
I've got the bee spray, which I don't do enough of.
They've all been shown in massive clinical trials to have no effect in normal, healthy people. Okay, so...
What about the athletic greens? All the greens. We take the athletic greens as well, don't we? You could be saving me a lot of money here, Tim, so just tell me how it is.
I'd rather you spent money on a good diet than all these supplements, which at best probably don't work, and at worst can be harmful. If you take calcium supplements, we know they increase risk of heart disease, because you can get your calcium from a bit of broccoli or kale or even San Pellegrino, right? And your body absorbs it naturally, slowly into your body, just as evolution has intended. But if you take that, you know, vitamin D or that calcium as a big blob, your body can't process it the same way. You know, it ends up in the wrong places or can cause problems. So that's why some of these vitamins have been shown to actually increase problems. You can overdose on vitamin D, on vitamin E, and it can have, you know, side effects. So we shouldn't be popping these things just like your fruit pastilles of your youth. You know, realize that they are chemicals you're putting into your body, right?
Yeah.
Because we call them vitamins, it's like, okay, they're not, you know, vitamin D is actually more like it's more like a steroid. It's in the steroid family. But we don't say I'm taking steroids. It's a vitamin, as if that makes it okay. It means we don't have to worry about it. But if we're having, extra chemicals, you know, you're getting confusing chemicals added to your food chemicals that your gut microbes there are trying to process and, you know, create some good chemicals to help your immune system. So you mess that up in ways that no one's studying when clinical trials are showing they don't work, is daft, really, if you can afford a decent diet and, you know, plenty of fresh vegetables. So that's it. And I think it's symptomatic of this country in the US that we don't have a strong food culture. So we're desperate for this sort of insurance policy. So I don't really know what to eat, but, you know, my wife's given me this bag of vitamins and I'm going to take them. Because that way,
you basically just summed me up there. Yeah.
That way I'm covered. Whereas, you know, that's why you should read my book and actually understand.
My wife read all your books, and then
no. But I'm just saying, I think everyone needs to not use you.
Yeah.
Understand more about food, and what the good things are about food, and how having a range of foods every day, diversity, guarantees you all the vitamins and nutrients you ever need. In the way that your body has been designed to evolve for millions of years to use efficiently. So you don't get overdoses, you don't get deficiencies, you know, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's like vitamin D. We were designed to get our vitamin D by going out in the sun. And yet, modern world, you know, women's face creams all contain blockers to stop that vitamin D. So, you know, we just need to think about our past and our evolution and just say that's the way to get vitamin D. The odd, you know, yes, plants and mushrooms and whatever can give you vitamin D, but also 10 minutes in the sun. You know, it's just, that's why we've evolved to have pale skins. It's very simple. So throw away most of this stuff, you'd save yourself a fortune and you could afford the most amazingly exotic vegetables and you know, meal delivery systems and whatever instead, and you'd be much better off.
Wow, all right then. So I make a smoothie every morning. I'm gonna chuck this in there now. So in there, and it's got bigger and bigger. This could be saving us a lot of money, couldn't it, Jem?
Is this the fruit pastilles in there?
We spend a lot of money on food and supplements. I'm talking thousands of pounds a month. So in my smoothie goes turmeric, cinnamon, creatine, 2 scoops of, sourced by my wife, natural protein, mixed nuts, blueberries, raspberries, ice, coconut milk, and ginger and a seed mix, and kefir. And that makes about 2.5 big glasses, and I put that down every morning. Are you going to rip that to bits now as well?
You're looking very nervous, aren't you?
I will listen to you. I can take feedback.
Most of that is pretty good. Okay. I think you got 90% of that right.
Yeah.
Okay. The coconut milk, I don't see the reason for that. It's great if you're making a curry, but I wouldn't have it.
Sorry, coconut water. Yeah, you're okay. Right. Coconut water.
All right. Well, I would probably just have water.
Okay, fine.
I don't think there's anything magical about coconut water
other
than the price. and the rest of it, you're getting, if you've got a nut and seed mix, you're getting variety in there.
Yeah.
And you're getting your berries. I like the idea of the spice mix in there.
Yeah.
That's really good because we know that it's proven that if you have, a teaspoon of spices every day, it's good for your gut health.
Yeah.
And your kefir, would you have yogurt as well, or was it just kefir? I think it sounds good.
Yeah.
You can give me the list afterwards. I'll see if there's anything else I would add. But do you like it?
I love it. That's
the most important. It's got to taste good, right? Yeah. If it tastes horrible, there's no point.
It does taste good. And I could probably put a couple of vegetables in it as well, because I don't mind that vegetable taste.
Yes, I mean, it is a bit, it's pretty quite sugary, because you've got lots of fruits in there.
That's probably why I love it.
Yeah,
because of my sugar addiction.
So you might start experimenting with adding some base of other vegetables that would have a bit of fibre in there. Because you've got a bit in the nuts and seeds, and a bit in the berries, but you could work out other ways of getting.
And what would
a
be good?
Fiber.
What vegetables would be high in fibre?
Things like spinach, kale. You could, you could stick some mushrooms in there. You just experiment on what tastes work for you.
Okay.
Most greens are good, and you just need to get that balance right, so it's not doesn't all stuck in your teeth and funny. But I think that's the only thing I would change. But that's a pretty good base.
Yeah.
So with that, you absolutely don't need all that other chemical synthetic stuff.
Okay. All right.
So you're doing well there.
What are your thoughts on MSG? Is it the poison we once thought it was?
It's been shown not to be in randomized controlled trials. So I, like everyone else, used to go to Chinese restaurants and say, "Oh, I got a headache after it, and it must be that MSG." But there have been at least five or six studies now where they've given like 20 volunteers a sort of dummy MSG and a real MSG, and they couldn't find a difference between it. So I think it's one of those old myths that somebody wrote up a case report in a medical journal, and then other people sort of said, "Oh yes, I had that problem. I had a headache when I went to a Chinese restaurant." So poor old Chinese restaurants have had a terrible rap on the basis of this. Obviously, it's still used a lot in Japan and China as to give sort of umami flavoring, that sort of more savory flame to it.
Mm.
Obviously, overdoing one chemical is not good. It's a sign of ultra processing, but there's nothing wrong with it itself.
Mm.
If people want that flavor, then maybe they should go to more miso, soy sauce, Tabasco sauce, those sort of flavorings that are perhaps not quite as chemical as that. But it doesn't cause that MSG syndrome.
Mm.
That seems to be psychological.
Mm. Tim, I would like to know, how do you get your kids off shit foods and onto a good diet?
Well, from personal experience, it's not easy, because peer pressure means that they're often given other foods by other parents or kids when they go around, and so they've...
Or what schools give them.
Or what their schools... And school food is pretty dreadful. I was very lucky. My kids went to a French school, and they had fantastic school dinner. It was like a Michelin-starred restaurant, by equivalent. So they did get used to what good school food is. They had a real shock when they moved to an English school at the age of 11. They basically didn't eat for the first year. But I think the way is very, early on is to get them used to eating vegetables, give them a new vegetable to eat or plant to eat every week or every day, so that it becomes a game, and they can you know, take bites and say, so it's making, giving them a much bigger choice of foods than they've been used to, I think is one of the keys to this. So they can say, you know, I've got these six ones here, which one am I going to have today? There is a period of time, I know it's a bit late for your kids, but other people might know that there's a period of time between about 1 and 4 when kids are actually quite receptive to eating nearly anything. I remember my kids, you know, would eat olives and anchovies and pickles. And if you can get those tastes in there, you know, kimchi, you do broaden their palates. Mm. But if you got some of your kids at that age, I think you've got to make it a bit of a game, and you know, just remove the chips and the potatoes and say, well, you're not going to have chips and potatoes. We're going to have other alternatives. See what else is,
yeah.
See what else we've got, and eventually kids get hungry and they will try stuff, and you know, there are people who work with children just say, well, you have to keep presenting it. You can't expect them to like it the first time, and you know, but don't worry about it.
Mm.
Kids won't starve.
Mm.
They will always, you know, they will all come back and eat. So it's persevering. It's showing them that these things are healthy, these things are unhealthy. Telling them, you know, these things will make you hungrier. Explain to them, you know, that you had that problem at their age, and it was because you weren't taught about what real food, good food was, and that was driving your appetite.
Mm.
Tell them it, you know, it also, where they get allergies, you know, that's another reason to have healthy foods. And try and change some of the basic things. So make sure they don't have children's yogurt. They have adult foods. They don't go for the children's menu. They go for the adult menu. Make them feel grown up.
Mm.
Make them realize that orange juice is a no-no. It's a special treat, not something you should have every day. You know, introduce them early to tea and coffee. Get them used more to bitter tastes. Wean them off the artificial sweeteners, which just ramp up their threshold for sweetness. Mm. And if that all fails, bribe them.
That was great. Tim, we're going to do something else we haven't done on my show ever. We've got two props. Would it be okay for you to close your eyes for about 5 seconds? I just don't want you to see them.
Okay.
Hopefully you trust us enough that we're not going to do anything. It's very simple, but if you wouldn't mind just closing your eyes.
All right.
I'm yeah?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So first off, this is a protein bar I eat probably too much of. So you don't have to say the name of the brand. I don't want to shame any brand if you rip it apart. But if you have a look at the ingredients, is that protein bar? It says vitamin and protein bar.
Vitamin and protein bar, yeah. Yes. With chocolate salted caramel flavour.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, if you could have a look at the ingredients and tell us
And why do you take this? Just because you're hungry or?
No, I take it because I understand. I take it because I believe that increasing protein is good for, I wouldn't say building muscle because I'm not a bodybuilder, but I am under the impression that a high protein diet is good as you get older, and it's good if you do exercise for your muscles. So that's why I take, put protein in my shakes and in the morning and have one, maybe two of them a day even.
Okay, well, it's got eight, yes, per serving, which is 55 grams, it's got 8 grams of fat. It's got 15 grams of carbs, which is about 4 spoons of sugar. And it's got 3.5 grams of fiber, which is, yeah, about a tenth of your sort of requirement. And you've got your 20 grams of protein, which is, so you're getting a lot of protein, but you're also getting a lot of sugar in that. And it's got these other vitamins in there, none of which you really need in fairly small doses. And it's presumably highly, it doesn't actually say what the other ingredients are. So this is odd. It must be somewhere hidden. Oh yeah, here we are. So the key.
So as Tim unfolds the hidden part of the wrapper.
So the key is the ingredients are milk protein, milk chocolate with sweetener, malitol, cocoa butter, whole milk powder, cocoa mass, emulsifier, lecithins, soya, collagen, hydrolysate, humectant, glycerol, isomalto, oligosaccharide, water, soya crispies, soya protein, starch, barley, natural vanilla flavoring, cocoa powder, cocoa mass, natural flavoring, salt, vitamins, and then list of all the vitamins. And it's got extra sweetener, sucralose. So that list is frightening. So you consider this, oh, this is a good way of getting protein.
Yeah.
And gives you your 20 grams of protein, which you feel you need. It gives you 4 spoons of sugar, but it's giving you about an extra 20 chemicals into your gut, many of which are harmful for it. And so overall, this is ultra processed food and is not good for you.
Okay, thank you. That's what I probably didn't want to hear, but I like truth.
Do you like it?
And the next one is we have a bottle of Prime, which all the kids are going wild for. Can you have a look at the ingredients and tell us what you think of those?
Okay, so so I'm looking first at the nutrition information, and it says there's only per 100 mils, it's hardly any calories here. So it's virtually calorie free, no fat, no carbs. According to this, there's nothing in it. And then you read the ingredients. It's got filtered water, reconstructed coconut water, citric acid, mineral salt, dipotassium, natural flavoring, color, beta and carotene. It's got multiple sweeteners, sucralose, sulfame, K, amino acids, isoleucine, leucine, valine, and vitamin A, B, B6, B12. And so I guess it's trying to say this has got extra amino acids in here, and that's why you're drinking it, but plus a whole mass of sweeteners and sort of zero calories. So yeah, again, this is a protein drink that's full of chemical sweeteners, which would be fantastic if sweeteners weren't bad for you. But we know in some people they give you a sugar peak and stimulate your brain to want more sweet things. So for kids particularly, I think this is dangerous. It just changes their threshold and their appetite signals. They want to seek out really sweet things rather than bitter things. And we now know that artificial sweeteners, all of them, affect our gut microbes so that they affect the products they make, they reduce your gut health and have other impacts we yet to find out. So again, it all comes down to, you know, how badly do you need protein? Do you need protein enough to ingest all these extra chemicals that are doing you harm?
Well, can I ask you then? Yeah. Because I've been led to believe through the research my wife does, because I run the business and do all the research on business and entrepreneurship and all the staff we have and all of this, and she takes care of the food information. So I understand as you get older, your muscles, it's harder to retain muscle. And so having a high protein diet as you get older is important to retain your muscle, which is good for your longevity of life. And been led to believe that if you want to retain muscle and even grow muscle, if you're training, you want to look good, you need more protein. What are your thoughts on those?
They are all true, but most of the protein experts in nutrition that don't have a product to sell, so we get easily enough protein on the average diet. Probably get more than we need. You can't store protein in your body other than unless you're building muscle. So drinking a lot of protein one day, it just goes straight through you, uses a fair bit of energy, your body processes to break it down and get rid of it. It's quite hard for the body. So it's quite hard to actually drink a lot, eat a lot of protein in a day. Humans are not sort of designed to do that. You know, if we were meant to store protein, we'd have had a special organ that stores it up for when we need it. I think there are some exceptions when you might need extra protein. One is, as you get into your 70s, you start to lose lean mass more dramatically than the very steady sort of decline at other ages. And so there's a feeling that older people might need some protein supplements or just change the diet, particularly if they're vegetarian, might need to really focus on high protein foods. And the others are sort of professional athletes and bodybuilders. But if you're not in that category, there's no evidence that you need extra protein or it's any good for you, or, and particularly children need it. Mm. It's and this is a bit of a con, that you're selling protein to kids who want to be, you know, big and strong like their dad. They need to exercise and do something. They're not going to get it from a drink that's full of nutrient sweeteners that's going to mess up their insides and their immune system.
Steroids. I'd love to talk about steroids. And we've had some very strong men on this show. And we've had some very open conversations about steroids and some closed ones. And I'm hoping we can have an open conversation here. So what are your thoughts on steroids? You know, for example, testosterone replacement therapy, or, you know, even the more hardcore steroids that bodybuilders use.
Well, I'm no expert on this. So first, this is just general medical knowledge that testosterone replacement for men, in my view, should only be used when you test blood for testosterone and free testosterone, you find it's low and someone has symptoms. You know, the beard stops growing, they can't get erections, they're not, you know, don't have any libido. Then testosterone treatment can be worthwhile, and there, people on other medications sometimes need this as well, chemotherapy, etc., etc. As a sort of recreational tool, it comes with many, many risks and safety concerns. So, heart disease, giving you acne. Potentially cancer of the prostate you can be caused. So I don't see any real reason that anyone would want to put their health so much at risk. They would take it just to build a little bit more bicep for, you know, a few months. It doesn't make any sense to me. And it's similar with anabolic steroids, which I think you're talking about, rather than corticosteroids. Anabolic steroids, again, used by athletes. Yes, there are some athletes who, you know, will do anything to win a medal and don't mind dying 10 years earlier, and most Olympic athletes have that mindset. You know, if I get my gold medal, I'll die early, I don't mind. Most people, I don't think, are like that. I don't think they would sacrifice 10 years of their life to do that. So, I'm not for them, but I'm certainly not an expert, I've never taken them. And I'm not an Olympic athlete either. So, I think some things, you know, are too strong to be played with, really. And I don't see why people would risk everything just to get bigger muscles.
Mm. Do you know who the Liver King is? So he blew up on social media by essentially saying that eating raw liver makes you a strong man, and he eats all these raw organs. And actually, incidentally, it just came out recently that he was on steroids and he'd lied about it for a long time.
Raw liver plus steroids is a good combo, isn't it?
So, is eating raw liver good for growing muscle?
Not particularly, no. I think you get as much muscle from soybeans or, you know, mushrooms or peas. So it's a fallacy, really, that you can only get muscle if you eat meat. It's true that meat has a sort of perfect balance of the amino acids, but if you have a very balanced vegetarian diet, you will get all those amino acids from different plants by combining them. And so this is just exacerbating this sort of myth that you have to have meat to be strong. And there are many vegan athletes and weightlifters now, and you know, about a quarter of the population are vegetarian.
Wow.
of the planet, so several billion people. We don't have to eat animals to get muscle.
So,
and raw is nothing special either. So, generally, it's much harder to digest raw meat than cooked meat, and so you get less nutrients from it.
Isn't cooking essentially pre-digestion? Isn't that what it is?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's why we're able to shrink down our guts as we evolved. We used to have very long guts, like a lot
before
of the other apes.
Yeah.
And so all our energy went into our intestines as we were eating raw meat. Mm. And as we learned to cook about a million years ago, our guts shrank, and that allowed us to have the energy to have bigger brains. Mm. So cooking is absolutely essential. And all my reading around generally cooking foods, because there have been other raw food movements saying, isn't it great, you know, you can cure cancer with this raw food, it's incredible. All my reading is that lightly cooking plants and meat is the thing that gives you the most nutrients from those foods,
right,
rather than raw. There are a few exceptions, but generally slightly cooking things is the way to go, and there's really no evidence of raw food diets being healthy at all.
So three questions, two selfish for me and one for everyone else. How do you get yourself off a sugar addiction? That's obviously for everyone else, not me. I mean, is it even healthy and helpful to call it a sugar addiction? Like, as I sit here, I can hear those cookies calling to me, and I have got this magnetic pull towards sugar, and I see it in everyone. How do we get off that? Because surely that's a good start.
I think all of us have realized that you can change. I mean, when I was young, I used to have my tea with 4 teaspoons of sugar in it. Now I have my tea with nothing in it. And if you take that as an example of all kids start, they can't have coffee or tea or anything without sugar, and then they wean themselves off it. So I think you can slowly withdraw the sugar from your diet, but to do that you've also got to give up the artificial sweeteners. And a lot of people replace, like you did, the sugar with artificial sweeteners, which gives them initial benefit but is still lighting up your brain, so your brain wants those dopamine signals saying, you know, feed me, this is my addiction. So the sweeteners are just a way of delaying the problem and sometimes making it worse. So I think it's shifting to a more pro-fat diet, more pro-protein diet, reducing the refined carbs, making sure that you eat stuff that takes longer to digest so you don't get these big sugar peaks and troughs. I'd love to get you to do the Zoe nutrition study, actually, because what we've done now is we've had about 70,000 people do this study now, where everyone gets an identical set of muffins, and we see how much the sugar peak goes up, you know, an hour after eating a muffin, how big is your sugar peak, and does it dip again? And we get about a 20-fold difference between people.
Wow.
So some people hardly react at all. They just bounce it off. They don't get a big buzz. Others go right up and then 3 hours later get crashed down again. And they're the ones that seem to have this real sugar craving, and they eat much earlier the next meal, and they get even hungrier than the people who don't have those sugar peaks.
Mm.
And this is all very new from these Zoe studies. But if you, so the way to counteract that, so you could be one of these sugar dippers that when you have a, when you have that first bit, it then in a way sets you up for 3 hours later wanting exactly the same, and your brain absolutely obsessed with it. So if you can stop that first thing happening in the morning, you don't have carbs in the morning, you give yourself your full fat yogurt and nuts, and you don't get a sugar peak, you're much less likely to trigger your brain to say you're going to get that later on. And you've got to cut out all sweet things and just gradually get yourself to appreciate more bitter, sour flavors, more interesting flavors, and wean yourself off these chemicals. Mm. I think it's a combination of those things. But don't say I can never have them, because that's a recipe for disaster. You've got to give yourself a treat and say, okay, once a week I'm going to go and have my donuts or your whatever your Jaffa cakes or whatever it is that you've been so dreaming about. Mm. But because our philosophy, you know, the philosophy I've got and that of Zoe is that there's nothing's off limits. It's just as long as the rest of the week you're eating really well, you can cope with that.
Yeah.
Your body will cope with it. It won't, you know, hopefully you just get out of your system, you get that, you know, your Jaffa cake hit, and then you move on. Mm. But if you start with your muesli breakfast or your toast in the morning, you get your sugar dip at 11 o'clock, you are craving sugar.
Yeah.
And that's what we find. One in four men and one in three women in our studies is happening. And we're now just starting to be able to identify who they are and sort of warn them, send them a message on the app and say, listen, yeah, watch out. But I think all those artificial sweeteners you're taking, that's your downfall.
Yeah. Noted. Feedback received loud and clear.
But it's not easy, you know, and you've got to take it slowly. So, you know, I wouldn't advise going cold turkey.
No.
Just do it gradually.
Yeah.
Like when we were kids, we didn't, I presume you don't have 4 spoons of sugar in your tea.
No, I don't have any sugar in coffee. No, none.
So that's...
Yeah, that's fine.
That's shown you can do it.
Yeah. Eating late at night, is that a thing that's bad?
For most people, yes. Unless they are, have to as their shift workers. It all depends on when you're going to sleep. So eating just before you go to sleep is not a good idea, because your body does need several hours to really process the food and get rid of it. It's less efficient. So it will then hang around in your body. Your body's still working when it should be resting. So it's all about getting your circadian rhythms lined up. So in the day, you're eating, you're exercising, you're active, and then you have this rest period when everything's switched off. That's when your body is most efficient. And so more and more we're realizing how important these circadian clocks are and rhythms. And the late night snack is really terrible. Not only for messing up that rhythm, it messes up your sleep, and it messes up your gut microbes. And as we were talking early on about this time-restricted eating, you're then only giving yourself, 8 hours for your body to recover when it needs probably 14. So the only way around that is if you've got, a special personal life that means you're working late or whatever, you mustn't eat anything, until lunchtime the next day to give yourself a decent break. But generally, these snacks late at night, which are part of many people's culture in front of the telly and whatever, are bad for you.
Mm. Okay, final question. How do you live a long and healthy life? Like, what would be the 3, maybe pushing 5, core things we can do? Bearing in mind we're all busy and got lots of things on, some simple things we can do to live a longer, healthier life.
Eat a good diet that you enjoy that's good for your gut microbes. Okay, one which is mainly plants, lots of diversity. Exercise most days of the week with a sport or exercise you enjoy to get your body moving and your improve your brain. And I think the other thing is to make sure you have a really good group of friends and a community around you to support you in particularly as you get older. Realize that your friendship group and your social group is actually really key to your physical and your mental health. Surround yourself with optimistic people who can really lift your spirits. I think they're the, if I had to pick three, they would be the three for me.
And one thing, just slip this one in because you reminded me, that you said that exercise and weight loss, you said something about that as a bit of a myth. Did I catch right?
Yeah, I'm recommending exercise as proven to be really good to reduce all kinds of diseases and reduce the rate of aging. Okay, so exercise by itself is undoubtedly good at preventing all kinds of diseases, whether immune disease, infections, aging, whatever, heart disease, cancer, but it is not a good way to lose weight. Okay, that is proven.
How is it proven? Isn't that how most people lose weight?
No.
Is that how most people think they're losing weight?
It's how most people think they will lose weight when they sign up for the gym in January and pay an enormous amount and said, oh, if I paid this money, I'm going to go to the gym, I'm going to lose weight. And they don't pay attention to the diet, they will not lose weight. There are over 20 studies now doing long-term follow-up of people on taking up exercise only and saying what happens. They might initially lose a bit for the first week or two, and then again the same mechanisms with calorie restriction start kicking in, appetite goes up, your metabolism drops, and this has been shown in many studies. There was a great study of marathon runners crossing America doing a marathon every day, and they lost weight for the first week, quite a lot of that, and then their metabolism slowed down so much they didn't lose any more weight.
Wow.
For the next 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And this is what exercise does. It's you can't outrun a bad diet. I think that's the key here. So start, if you want a diet, improve the quality of a diet. You know, think about diet differently. Think about your glucose spikes, whether you're should be someone eating lots of carbs or lots of fats, and focus on the quality, but don't think that just going to the gym twice a week is going to make you slim. Now, as always, there will be some exceptions, and as we discussed before, but the percentage is really very small that can do that. Once you've lost some weight, exercise is a good way to stop it creeping back as quickly as it would otherwise do. So I'm a big fan of exercise, but let's not raise expectations. On its own, it's a useless weight loss tool. It's good for maintaining health. It's very good for everything else.
Okay, so let's go back to me when I'm 11. What would have been the best way to lose that weight? The most sustainable way, the quickest way without the side effects?
It would have probably been a combination of changing it to a whole food diet, giving up all ultra processed foods. It would have been saying you can only eat within this time restriction, so you only eat within a 10-hour period, and maybe include maybe skipping breakfast, which the government still says is, NHS says is harmful, which isn't. It would been giving you fermented foods to eat to improve your gut health. So you'd be having regular yogurts, kefirs, kimchis. Probably didn't have them then, but even, good quality cheese. And it would getting you up to doing exercise at the same time, so you could then maintain that weight you'd lost, and give yourself a bit more confidence as well. As you're losing that fat, how you could sort of maintain it in that way, and just get some general rules about snacking and drinks. In the UK, nearly a quarter of our calories come from snacks and drinks. So, particularly for kids, if you control that, you can do a pretty good job. Mm. It would be teaching your 11-year-old self what good food looks like and what junk food as an occasional treat looks like. Mm. And don't confuse the two.
Right. And where can we follow you, Tim? Could we get some people listening to go onto your Zoe app and do this? I wrote it down, this study you're doing. What books would you like us to go to first?
Well, follow me on Instagram, where I talk about nutrition a lot.
And your
Tim.Spector.
Tim.Spector, yeah.
You can also follow Zoe on Instagram, which is the personalized nutrition company. And if you're interested in getting tested yourself to see whether how you respond to foods in a personal way and being given an eating program that doesn't involve calories, just involves personalizing food for you and on an app, you go to joinzoe.com and you can join the 70,000 people that have already done that. And you also get a microbiome test. So you get for your, as part of the kit, you get a continuous glucose monitor, which you stick on your arm yourself. That measures your blood glucose every 5 minutes, and you get that on your phone, which is really cool, fun thing to do. You measure your fat levels 6 hours after eating something to see how much fat is hanging around, to see whether you should be eating lots of fats or not. And then your gut microbiome test will tell you how healthy or not your gut is and change the advice. We put all those things together into a score that means that every food that you want to eat or construct a meal of, you get a personal score from 0 to 100. And whether it's Jaffa cakes or it's a coconut Thai curry, you can score it and improve it with other things. And that's something is sustainable for years. And you get virtual nutritionists helping you. So that's through joinzoe.com. There's also a free app for people who don't have spare money at the moment, where we educate people. And we're currently doing a study on health habits. So we had 110,000 people doing time-restricted eating, and we just used the app to see how many people improve their mood, etc. And there's other ones on there as well. That's called the Zoe Health Study app, and that's free to download. And many other interesting experiments and things that it's more of a community science project. And then finally, for education, the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast has nutrition topics every week from a group of experts that's all free for everyone to download and find out about. So we're very much in the business of trying to re-educate everyone about food. But the key thing is that food is to be enjoyed. Mm. And absolutely, that's definitely my ethos. We should all enjoy what we eat. That's life's too short otherwise.
Mm. And then you were to pick one of your books, which should we read first?
Well, the easier read is Spoon Fed, which is a small paperback about these myths and about the food industry. Those who want to get a more depth, practical guide to a sort of A to Z of food and about, you know, what type of lentil to pick or what type of cabbage or lettuce or whether fish is good or bad for you, it's Food for Life. And both are available now. Buy both.
Buy both.
And they're also available on Audible, and people are like listening to them as well. So many people do that now. Mm. Very long podcasts, 14-hour podcast.
Tim, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.